And welcome to Juno Afternoon on this fine Thursday. My name is Shona Strasser and happy to be with you here today. We have a great show lined up for you today. Fumi Matsumoto and Jane Terry will be here to highlight their first Friday show at the Jack. We'll get a preview of this Saturday's speakeasy, Drink from the Well. We'll talk with Steve Hinrichsen about his Friday lecture at the Alaska State Museum, an expert on clinket armor. And Nancy DeCherney will be here, as with every Thursday, with Arts Up, Writer's Almanac, music and more. This Thursday, today, on KTOO. And first off, let's hear some National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. New York State is ironing out its gaming relationships with its native neighbors. Meanwhile, New York voters will decide this fall whether to build new casinos that would compete with tribal ones. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
Last spring, the Oneida Nation, the Seneca Nation, and the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe worked out exclusivity agreements with New York in the regions where their five casinos are located. Yesterday, Seneca Nation President Barry Snyder Sr. joined Governor Andrew Cuomo in Niagara Falls to deliver $140 million to local communities, money that had been withheld for several years while the Native Nations negotiated with the state. The Oneidas and Mohawks have followed suit. Now the rest of upstate New York is fair game for gambling competition. Cuomo has signed a bill to allow up to four non-native casinos to be built outside the exclusivity zones, and he says New Yorkers should approve it.
If we don't do it in New York, people go to Pennsylvania, people go to Massachusetts, people go to Connecticut, people go to Native American casinos as we have here in Western New York. So it's not really a question of gaming or not gaming. Whether we like it or not, we're there.
The gaming expansion would require amending the state constitution. That means voters will have to pass the bill in a referendum in November. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
A court in South Carolina has finalized the adoption in the baby Veronica case, transferring custody of a little girl to a non-native couple. As Kurt Gortney with KGOU reports, the father of the girl is continuing his legal fight for custody.
The lawyer for Matt and Melanie Capobianco says the adoption of Veronica by the couple is now complete. On Wednesday, attorney James Fletcher Thompson also said a plan was in place to transfer the child from the custody of her father, who lives in Oklahoma. The lawyer did not share details, and the South Carolina court hearing was closed to the public. The hearing went ahead despite last-minute lawsuits seeking to stop the adoption. An attorney representing the Cherokee Nation sought an injunction arguing that Veronica's rights were being violated by the court. The legal filing sought a hearing to determine the best interests of the child. Veronica, who is now three, is the biological father of Dustin Brown, a member of the Cherokee Nation. He has argued the Indian Child Welfare Act means he should have custody of Veronica. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court before being sent back to South Carolina. Several Native American groups, including Oklahoma's Cherokee Nation, have filed federal lawsuits in connection with the case. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
A northern Wisconsin county backed down this week from trying to evict people at the Lacoutere Harvest Camp near a proposed mining area. As Mike Simonson reports, another tribe, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, is looking to start a camp of its own, also in that area.
The camp would be about the same size as the Lacoutere Harvest Camp, about 5 acres. And Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says it'd be a spiritual camp run by tribal elders.
When our elders get into those ceremonies, what comes with that is a humbleness, recognizing that, you know, we are included in a part of those ecosystems that flow through our homeland. It also includes a humbleness that understands that as human beings, we need nature. We need those ecosystems. Nature and ecosystems don't need us.
Wigan says the spiritual camp is not in reaction to a move by Iron County to evict people from the LCO Harvest Camp, but it is in opposition to the proposed 4.5-mile-long open-pit iron ore mine in the Pinoki Range.
Resisting the environmental impacts of that mine, those ceremonies, those prayers are incredibly important, and those elders are doing all of our people a service by helping us all slow down and think about what's really at stake.
Wiggins hopes to open the spiritual camp this week. He says they're negotiating with private landowners and the Nature Conservancy for a location near Caroline Lake. That lake is significant because it's at the headwaters of the Bad River, which the band says would be polluted by an open-pit mine. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
Today we remember Ho-Chunk Elder Angie DeCora. She was a founding member of the American Indian Center in Chicago, Illinois. The center was organized in the 1950s by the Indian community to assist Native people in the area. DeCora passed away of cancer in August 2012. She was 91. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My name is Shona Strasser. Happy to be with you today. And also with me today, our first guest, Fumi Matsumoto and Jane Terry, talking to us about Masks and Muses, their first Friday opening show, actually, tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, Masks and Muses. And so what was the inspiration to come up with Masks and Muses? Why Masks and Muses?
Well, let's see. The muses, I've been saving all these found objects from the beach, you know, like driftwood and shells and barnacles and you name it, whatever I find, sea stars. And they were sitting on my shelf for several years. And finally, you know, we decided we were going to do a show, and Jane was interested in making a bunch of masks, which I was inspired after she started doing her masks to do some masks. But I thought, well, I'll do these muses and basically little inspirational figures, I guess you'd say.
Right.
It's hard to describe. I'll have to tell you about a couple of them, and you know, maybe that would make more sense what these muses are. It's just they sort of popped out of the materials that I had. Like, for instance, I saved up a whole bag of rubber plant leaves that were dried up, and I saw the image of a wolf and a fox. So there's a leaf wolf and a leaf fox made out of these leaves. And then I also was making some omelets, and I emptied out the egg carton. It was the last one. And then this image of a fox came and popped out of the egg carton, basically. So I put that together. And so I have an egg carton fox mask and Mickey and Minnie fox, you know, egg carton masks. And so, you know, there's quite a few different things. I also made one that I just made the other day, and it's called Hootie and the Hoodie. And it's like a weird little owl figure that came out of a driftwood piece, and I put that together, and he does. He looks sort of like a Hootie in a hoodie. But anyway, I should let Jane talk a little bit more.
Yeah, Jane, so did you start off this show, you know, creating this show thinking that you were going to do masks right away, or?
Yeah, masks was the theme to begin with. Our last show had muses in it, and masks go along with that because you have different faces that you put to the world and different thoughts that you put to your expressions, which kind of leads into masks. And all cultures around the world have different forms of masks. I came from an Eastern tradition where the Iroquois had a different form of masks than they have here. The Tlingit masks are much different, but I wanted to explore it a little bit. And when you choose a theme, it's like if an instructor gives you a theme, you suddenly have to think about that. And so the masks have led me down a rather strange path, because once I decided about the mask, then I had to think about the heads that I was going to put the masks on. And so I spent quite a bit of time delving into the facial aspects of the human form. And it's been an interesting side note, but it's really taught me a lot about the human face.
So you said you're using a lot of different kind of mediums here, found objects. What else are you using, Jane?
Well, the heads, I started out with paper mache heads, and then that led me to insulation foam, because I had the paper mache. Once I'd formed those, I had a perfect form to squirt the insulation foam in. And so I should compliment Good Hardware here in town because they supplied me with all my materials. So I made a bunch of heads out of foam, and that wasn't interesting. I've also made them out of copper wire. So I like working with copper wire, too. So those are the main paper mache, foam, and copper wire, yeah.
So we'll see all of your masks actually formed on a head, then.
Yeah, they're all sitting on a head. Yeah, and then I had to figure out how to put shelves underneath the heads. Well, then you have to have shoulders, and, you know, one thing leads to another when you talk about masks. It's not just sticking a mask on the wall.
Right, right. And Fumi, yeah. What are some of the other materials that you use as far as found objects and things go?
Oh, well, there's a bird mask that I call Cock a Mountain Dew. It's a rooster made out of Mountain Dew soda cans. And the last show we had, I had Mountain Dew parrots, which were a whole flock of parrots made out of Mountain Dew cans. And I don't really drink the stuff, but I have a son who likes to drink soda pop, so I have endless supplies, different kinds of cans. And then I used there's some clear plastic, I guess, what was in there? Mangoes. My parrot likes to eat mangoes, so I used the clear plastic mango and egg carton cans, and I made what I call the invisible bird, and it just looks like transparent container. And Mech Moo is made out of McDonald's cup and various food containers. And then I'm trying to think of what other masks I have. One thing that's interesting is Jane's masks are all on heads, and they incorporate the human, human skull, and then, you know, the facial features, etc. Mine are more representative of birds and animals. Like I have a duct tape wolf that I made out of a spaghetti box covered with duct tape. I have a duck that's called Duct Taped, and it's made out of a stuffed armature, but it's all wrapped in duct tape.
Oh, wow.
And and then, I know. It
this is a
laughing getting,
art we're talking about.
I know. It just started getting kind of crazy. You know, I mean, we're like, what are we going to do, you know, for these masks and muses? And once you start working, like I said, the material sort of made itself, you know.
The two of you have done past shows together before. Can you tell me a little bit about those shows? And then also, how did the two of you start to work together?
We met out at UAS in the ceramics department because we both have a ceramics background. And we both come from the same neck of the woods down in California. So we instantly had something in common to talk about. And we have the same weird sense of visual creativity.
And humor?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like one thing leading to another for mine, the materials speaking and becoming part of the creative process. I started using corn husk for hair on my heads. And then I just happened to think, well, I wonder if anybody ever used corn husk for making masks. And sure enough, there were Iroquois masks made out of corn husks, which are they're sacred. You don't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole. But I thought, well, I could use the same technique and make my own mask. So I made some corn husk masks of my own. And then the braiding process sent me to another well-found object, my potting soil bag. Let me see if I can cut that up in strips and braid it and make a mask out of that, and sure enough, I did that. So it just kind of leads you from one thing to another.
Oh, it's amazing that we're hearing about actually these, you know, these objects, because looking at it, people just might not be able to tell, right?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Well, unless it, you know, some of it's pretty obvious, like the Mountain Dew.
Right.
But
right.
You know, the other pieces, I made one out of crab. Oh, Jane and I both started using crab claws and shells that we found on the beach or whatever. And I use barnacles. There's Barnacle Bill and Shelley. And then I have the Surf and Muse, which is made out of bark that washed up on the beach and driftwood, and also a dried up lemon. And I got into making all these weird little muses out of citrus rinds that are dried up, like tangerines, lemons, and limes. I have one piece called 47 Ronin, and there are 47 heads made out of dried up limes and tangerines. unless you look at it, and the body's made out of coffee filters that have been hand dyed into different colors. And so when you first look at it, you know, you may not know what it is, but if you look very closely, or actually it's going to be behind a plexiglass box, but if it was open, it smells just like lemons and tangerines.
Nice. How many pieces in your show tomorrow?
Oh, together? Let's see.
Well, I have 18.
I have probably at least 20. But
oh, great.
Mine are smaller. Jane's are like full-size life-size heads.
That's amazing.
And then I have a couple older people that are going to be coming out of a corn patch, so they're full size. So, yeah, I kind of got carried away.
Will these pieces be for sale, some of them? Or?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, great. And can you give us the details one more time, just where you're going to be, what time, and that would be great.
Well, let's see. The opening, first Friday, will be tomorrow, and 4:30 to 7.
Yeah, 7.
And we're at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, which is right across the street from K2. And what is
and they're going to be refreshments.
Oh, yeah,
they're
going to
have
right.
crackers and cheese and grapes.
Yeah, yeah, fruit and whatever. But I think it'll be really interesting and a fun show. That's the thing. I mean, Jane and I were having a lot of fun with this one. Well, we have fun with all of our shows. But this one in particular, I kept saying to Jane, this is really funny.
Yeah, the creative process, it's fun when you just think about the creative process itself.
Yeah.
It's a meditation, but it's also a way to communicate, and Fumi and I have figured out a way to have fun with it and still share ideas and visions.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Jane Terry and Fumi Matsumoto, for talking about your show, Masks and Muses, at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council tomorrow for First Friday at 4:30 in the gallery there. It's nice having you on.
Great. Thanks very much. Thank
and
you.
I hope everybody comes. Thank
yeah,
you so
hope
much.
To see you there. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Are we really happy with this lonely game we play? Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. In the studio with me, I have Joe Wolfenstein, and you're here to talk to us today about Saturday Speakeasy, which is, I think is super cool, and it's actually called Drink from the Well.
Right.
Well, welcome to the studio. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's so exciting to be here. I'm really excited to talk about our event.
Yeah. So let's give some details first. So where actually is the event? What time does it start and all that stuff?
Okay, well, it's out at McGivney's, which if you don't know where that is, it's the old GW Teal, so it was just purchased by Dave McGivney, and they've redone it. It's absolutely gorgeous. Brand new hardwood floors, put in a kitchen and everything. So we're really excited. And it's at 9 p.m. And it's just going to go till the party stops rocking. And there's also a free shuttle to and from Marine Park. So there's a shuttle at 9 p.m. and 9:45 to go out, and we'll just have them come back as we need them. So that's kind of where it's at and when it's starting.
That's fabulous. So, Joe, what's the impetus, you know, because it's not called Drink from the Well without a reason.
Right. So obviously there's a reference to the well at the bar, right? But our purpose is much, much deeper than that. So last year I had the amazing privilege to fundraise money with my best friend through the most incredible organization in the world called Groundwork Opportunities, based out of California. And we were fortunate enough to raise the money to build a sustainable farm in Uganda in Africa. And there's just so much more work to be done there. You know, almost 4 million people every year in Africa die from contaminated water. And it's really difficult for them to obtain it. They have to walk 5 miles to get clean water. And maybe that water is shared with animals. So they just have a really hard time having access to fresh water. So we wanted to change that. You know, we built this farm and we're making a difference over there, but we want it to be a continued effort. So we are raising money to buy a drill that will be able to drill them 150 wells that that entire region needs. And that means nearly 1 million people will be having fresh water by the time our efforts are done.
Great. And so how did you get involved with this organization?
You know, I found them online. It was really great the way that it worked out. I had always researched programs in Africa, and not a single one ever fit what I felt I wanted to do. And after 10 years, over 10 years actually, just randomly stumbled across them online and, you know, had the greatest conversation with the founder of the organization just a couple of days after sending them an email, and decided that what they wanted to do and what they were attempting to do was in perfect alignment with what I wanted to do. And I have never been so blessed in my whole life as I have been since working with them. They're amazing.
That's great. So tell us a little bit about what's actually going to happen at this event. So it's you know, I like to say, you know, fundraiser. And I'm sure lots of people do that too. But so what's the fun part of this fundraiser?
Well, we've got a costume contest, first of all. So we encourage everyone to come in their best 1920s attire. And we'll have a live pianist playing, you know, ragtime sort of music. So it'll be great. And we will also do a 1920s style dance lesson, so people can really get into the mood and start dancing like they did in the 20s. We've got raffles, we've got door prizes, we have silent auction items, we've got signature cocktails, we've got 4 appetizers that will be featured there for purchase. We have pin the beer in the hand, because it's all about prohibition, right? So that'll be a lot of fun. A poker table, just all sorts of really great fun stuff going on that evening.
And so you talked about your best friend working with her on this. Is she working on this event also? Or
she is actually in Utah, so she is not working on this specific event, but she has partnered with me again to fundraise for this effort. So we're doing this together to raise the money for this drill. And I'm really fortunate to have 2 amazing friends here in town that have given me countless hours and so much support, Megan Coyle and Jenny Monroe, who have really stepped up to the plate and helped me make this happen. So I just want to thank those girls so much for all they've done.
And it seems like you have a lot of other people in town who are really supporting this effort. When I look at your posters, you have tons of sponsors who are really helping out.
Oh, yeah.
And what kind of support are they providing?
We have donations from the Alaskan Brewing Company. We have prizes from Pearson's Pond, the Island Pub, North Star Trekking, Wings Airways, Nugget Alaskan Outfitters, Rebecca Brooks Jewelry. We've just got so much going on. The Flying Squirrel got involved and gave us some prize items. Skin Inspirations donated an amazing package that will be on silent auction at the event. And the free shuttle was so generously donated by Dolphin Jet Boat Tours. So it's like, it's a whole smattering of a bunch of different people all over town. You know, it's just really great to see so much support from local businesses.
So how much are you looking to raise? And then how much, you know, kind of in the bigger picture, what's the scope of money there?
Well, our overall attempt, and this is the largest single attempt that Groundwork Opportunities has taken on so far, is $30,000. That will cover the cost of the drill, and it will also help fund the first few wells that will be drilled. Typically, a well will cost about $4,500 to drill. With our own drill in hand, that will take it down to about $900. So for 150 wells, instead of nearly $700,000, we're going to be able to take on this effort for about $150,000. So with our efforts, with the first $30,000, we'll be able to take on the drill portion and the first few wells. So that's our overall goal. And as far as the evening goes, as long as we profit a couple thousand dollars to get us kickstarted and going, then that would be amazing.
As far as getting out there, you said the shuttles are happening because mm-hmm. this is in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll be taking people back and forth all evening.
Yeah, we'll run shuttles as we need. There are definitely two main shuttles going out, and then for return, we'll do as we need. But we're hoping that everybody's having so much fun, they just don't want to go.
And we talked a little bit about tickets. So mm-hmm. you give us the information on tickets, and is there still room?
There is no more room. We are sold out. We sold out in 4 days. So we have just had the most amazing response. So many people have wanted to get involved and attend and have fun. I've been called and texted and emailed, and even people stopping me in the street saying, the town is abuzz with this event. We're so excited for it. So we've had an overwhelming response. So unfortunately, there are no more tickets available. There is a place online that you can go to fundthedrill.eventbrite.com, and you can make a donation there if you would like to become involved without being able to actually attend the event.
Great. Can you give us that website one more time? Because I'm sure there's lots of people who would love to donate
yeah.
but just would like the resource.
It's fundthedrill.eventbrite, and that's spelled eventbrite.com. And there's a spot there where you can make a donation.
And as far as the organization goes, can we get the organization website so people can find out more information if they want it?
Yeah, it's groundworkopportunities.org. And they're phenomenal. They have this whole idea of investing in local leaders, of really taking the ideas that they have and putting the resources out there for them. Because the problem isn't that they aren't intelligent enough or bright enough to have these great ideas. They are. The problem is that they lack resources. So what Groundwork Opportunities' whole goal is to pair people that can fundraise the resources with these amazing local leaders who have great ideas and really empower people on the ground in these countries that have less resources available to them.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Jill. I really appreciate you coming on the air to talk about this today. And what a great event. Great
yeah.
luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, all right, so I'm being foolish. Well, all right, let people know about the dreams and wishes you wish in the night when lights are low. Well, all right, well, all right.
And thank you so much for tuning in to Juno Afternoon. My name is Shona Strasser, and we're going to hear up next here, Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, August 1st, 2013. It's the birthday of Herman Melville, born in New York City in 1819. When he was 20, he worked as a cabin boy on a ship that went from Liverpool and back, the first of his many voyages. Then in 1841, he joined the crew of the whaler Acushnet. Inspired by his adventures at sea, he returned to New York and settled down to write about his travels. After Melville got married, had 4 children, and moved to a farm in Massachusetts, he became friends with Nathaniel Hawthorne and went to work on his classic Moby Dick. Hawthorne encouraged him to make the novel an allegory, not just another high seas adventure story. When Melville finished his novel, he wrote to Hawthorne, to whom he dedicated the book, and said, "I have written a wicked book and feel as spotless as a lamb." He thought it was his best book yet. But when Moby Dick came out in 1851, the public did not agree. They found it too complex, too psychological, and his American publisher printed only a few thousand copies, most of which never sold. His next novel, Pierre, got terrible reviews, and publishers stopped wanting to publish his work. So Melville moved to New York, got a job as a customs inspector on the New York docks, where he worked for 19 years. The manuscript of his final work, Billy Budd, was found in his desk after he died, by which time he had become so obscure, his New York Times obituary called him Henry Melville. It's the birthday of the first professional woman astronomer, Maria Mitchell, born in Nantucket, Massachusetts in 1818, the third child of 10, born into a New England Quaker family, taught a bit by her father, but largely self-educated. Her parents encouraged their daughters, as well as their sons, to excel, and she became a noted scientist, which was very rare for a woman back then. She was the first to discover a comet with the use of a telescope, and was the first woman admitted to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She taught astronomy at Vassar and had a crater on the moon named for her. Maria Mitchell, who said, "Every formula which expresses a law of nature is a hymn of praise to God." And here's a poem by Carl Dennis entitled Still Life. "Now's a good time, before the night comes on, to praise the loyalty of the vase of flowers gracing the parlor table, and the bowl of oranges, and the book with freckled pages resting on the tablecloth, to remark how these items aren't conspiring to pack their bags and move to a place where stillness appears to more advantage. No plan for a heaven above, beyond, or within, whose ever-blooming bushes are rustling in a sea breeze at this very moment. These things are focusing all their attention on holding fast as time washes around them. The flowers in the vase won't come again. The page of the book beside it, the edge turned down, will never be read again for the first time. The light from the windows angled. The sun's moving on. That's why the people who live in the house are missing. They're all outside, enjoying the light that's left them. Lucky for them to find, when they return, these silent things just as they were. Night's coming on, and they haven't been frightened off. They haven't once dreamed of going anywhere." Still Life, a poem by Carl Dennis from his collection Ranking the Wishes, published by Penguin, and used here by permission on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org/mobile. This is Billy Collins, hoping you will join us here next time on the Writer's Almanac.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My name is Shona Strasser, and in the studio with me, I have the curator of collections at the Alaska State Museum, Steve Henriksen. Steve, thanks so much for joining me in the studio today.
Thank you.
And so you're here to talk to us today about actually a talk you're giving tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Alaska State Museum about Tlingit armor and ceremonial robes.
Yes, that's right. It's held in conjunction with our two solo artist exhibits that we have running right now, one by Tommy Joseph that has he's doing primarily Tlingit armor and weapons, and Kayfield Parker has done raven's tail weaving, and both of those art traditions are pretty ancient ones for this part of the world. The Tlingit and also some of the other tribes did them. And so I thought I'd pull together a program about the history of those two forms of art that takes that looks at the last 200 to 300 years of that art form and brings it from the beginnings up to the present.
That's interesting. And so will you be kind of talking about how, you know, kind of how and when the armor was used and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'll go into the traditions of those art forms as well as we know of what those traditions were from several centuries ago. And then there's a break in there because both of those art forms, both the armor and raven's tail weaving, were not produced the entire time. There was a break in production, and we're really not sure why they stopped making them. In the case of raven's tail weaving, sometime in the 1830s, the more familiar Chilkat robes were invented, and they proliferated, and at that point, raven's tail weaving was no longer made. But in that case, about 20 years ago, there was a resurgence of interest in that style, and a lot of weavers started picking it up, and Kay Parker was one of them. And in the case of armor, probably for some reason, maybe the introduction of firearms, they stopped making armor in the 1820s, 1830s, and it's only recently that artists like Tommy Joseph have reverse engineered it and are starting to make it again. And it's taken a lot of research because there are no elders that can be turned to who know how to make the old style armor. You basically have to use the artifacts themselves as the teachers. And there's many questions that we have about the process, like how do you prepare a moose hide or an elk hide to turn it into leather armor? We don't know exactly how they did it. So there's a period of experimentation to try to bring that back. And obviously today people aren't using the armor to fight in. It's more of an art object as we view it today. But originally that was a very practical and functional type of object. And what I'll talk about some tomorrow is how it was used traditionally. And some of the really interesting aspects of it. For instance, some of the armor is similar to armor used by the Chukchi people of Siberia, and there's other parts of it that are similar to samurai armor. And I'm not suggesting that there's a direct connection between the two, but you know, who knows? We know that Asian artifacts were traded into Alaska by pre-contact trade routes that existed from tribe to tribe. And the Tlingit warriors may have seen some samurai armor and picked up on some of the ideas of it. Or maybe the samurai saw some Tlingit armor and they picked it up. But it's just interesting some of the similarities that come up when you start looking at some of the older pieces.
As far as the armor goes, I mean, you said you were going to talk about 200 years, except for the missing kind of. What was the armor made of typically?
In Tlingit country, a warrior could wear a complete suit of armor that covered him from head to foot, or they could just wear parts of that. Like there's a basic part is a vest made out of several layers of very heavy leather, like maybe sea lion hide, that would protect the main trunk of the body from traditional weapons, spears and arrows primarily, and daggers. If depending on the kind of combat, the warrior might add to that some leg protectors that protected from the knee on down to the foot, and also a face protector and a helmet carved out of wood. And that would pretty much cover the entire body except for maybe the arms and the feet, but they were pretty well protected, and that would have served the purpose once while they were using traditional weapons like spears and arrows and daggers and clubs. Once firearms started to be brought into Southeast Alaska in the late 1700s, there's some indication that they started adding layers to that armor to make it more protection against, you know, bullets and buckshot. Some of the armor has three or four layers of both hide and wood and also sinew. And that's a similar construction to modern bulletproof vests, where they have multiple layers of very thin cloth, Kevlar, and that's capable of stopping a bullet. And maybe they, to some extent, this layering system that we see from 200 years ago is basically the same idea.
Wow, that's really interesting. So as far as, the ceremonial robes, how do you gather information for this, and what is your background, in Northwest art?
Well, I went to school at the University of Washington, where I had the good fortune of studying with Robin Wright and Bill Holm at the Burke Museum. They have a fantastic collection there, and just over the years, I've been in contact with a lot of researchers and also elders who still maintain a tremendous amount of information about how things were made and used, and also what the symbolism involved too. And both in the case of armor and in the raven's tail weaving, there's a lot of symbolism going on too. That may, in the case of armor, it may the symbolism may relate to clan identity. The figures depicted on the helmets, for instance, that are all carved in the form of animal heads and human heads, those could be spirit helpers, or they could be clan crests. In the case of raven's tail robes, those could certainly be clan crests as well. And there's a lot that we don't know about those traditions, and that's one of the things that came up when there was a debate about whether they should be brought back. I mean, just because, there was a reason why they stopped making it. We don't know what that reason was. So is it right of us to just say, oh, well, let's go ahead and start doing this again? And, it wasn't, there wasn't total consensus on what should be done. But in the case of raven's tail weaving, the people involved in starting that up again did a lot of consultation work with elders who had ties to early weaving, and the elders thought that it ought to be brought back. And in the long run, it has really made Northwest Coast weaving really take off. Chilkat weaving is a beautiful and unique art form, but it's something that you practically have to devote your life to be able to learn enough to weave a robe. Raven's tail is difficult, but it's more manageable for a lot of people, and I think it doesn't require the kind of lifelong commitment to learning how to do it. And so as a result, you go to any celebration or potlatch today and you see multiple pieces of it that are made by a member of the clan and given over. There's been even some pieces that have been brought out and they're considered clan property now, which is the highest, most esteemed level of property. So it's really, quite gratifying to see that the weaving coming back, and some of the raven's tail weavers have, based on their experience doing raven's tail, they've gone on to learn how to do Chilkat. So it's been kind of a training program, if you will, for getting more Chilkat weavers, and really that's an endangered art form. There's very, very few people in the world that have the knowledge to weave an entire robe. And we have at least two of them in our community here in Juneau. Clarissa Rizel and Anna Ellers are both capable of doing that. But really, there's not many more out there. And it's I would say, one of the most endangered forms of traditional art in the world.
Wow. And so could you tell us all one more time about the two artists in exhibition right now?
Sure. Tommy Joseph is a carver from Sitka, and he has been focusing in the last few years on doing Tlingit armor, and he's made new pieces of all of the major components of the armor that I was talking about earlier, plus some of the traditional weapons. And right next to that on display at the museum is the raven's tail weaving by Kay Field Parker. And Kay is not Tlingit. She's not native, but she's learned this form of art and is now is an instructor of it at the University of Alaska Southeast. And she's trained many, many people in how to do that. And she's done both very traditional work that would be indistinguishable from robes made a couple centuries ago, but she's also really done some innovative things with it, adding colors and creating new types of garments with it. It's really pretty exciting. She's taken the art form another step forward and has really done some exciting things with it. So I guess both exhibits have elements of the old and elements of the new in it. So it's not just purely copies of what was done 200 years ago.
Oh, that's amazing. Steve Hendrickson, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today. It's absolutely fascinating to just, you know, hear your knowledge about about ceremonial robes and armor. And you can hear more tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at the Alaska State Museum. So thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Juno Afternoon. My name is Shona. And before we have Ms. Nancy DeTurney with Arts Up, here's a little bit of Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Imagine you've found your way to a marsh, a forest, or other natural habitat, and you've spotted an unfamiliar bird. How do you figure out what it is? Apart from the color and size of the bird, what do you look for?
There it is. You see it?
A bird's behavior offers many clues. You'll see flycatchers flycatch, darting out from a branch to catch a bug in the air, and warblers warble, although sometimes it's hard to catch them in the act. To distinguish one bird from a similar one, watch what the bird does and how it moves. Does it flick its wings? Bob up and down? Flip its tail? A field guide usually mentions these behaviors, and watching for them can help you determine which bird is which. Is the bird feeding on the ground or high in a tree? Does it walk or hop? These distinctive actions give a bird personality.
There, back to the very top of that cedar. See how it works its way down that trunk?
Watching birds is a bit like detective work. Gather enough clues, and you'll solve the mystery. Elementary, my dear Watson. You'll find all kinds of resources for learning about birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon, and I'm so lucky to have in the studio with me, once again, Nancy DeTurney with Arts Up. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Shona.
And we're so excited, because tomorrow is actually something called First Friday.
I wonder what that is.
I have no idea. What is it, Nancy?
Well, you know, we come on every month, and we talk about First Friday and assume that everybody knows what First Friday is, but I got a phone call today that reminded me that some people are new to town, or they just don't know what it is. And so here's what it is.
Perfect.
You just come downtown and walk all around and go into all these stores are open. Most of them will have little refreshments there for you, and they have their artwork all laid out. There may be artists there that you can talk to, and there might be music. You just never know. But it's all free, and it's all in the downtown area, and it's a wonderful day tomorrow to walk around. So there's some really fun stuff. You know, this is August, and so you would expect it to not be so busy. But dang it.
Lo and behold.
We got ourselves a marathon walk today.
Nice.
We'll start out at the Arts Council because we have these little maps that you can get that has where everybody is and where is a little drawing. Here you go, here you go, there.
It's crucial. It's kind of like what I do for the folk festival.
Yeah, you need one of those.
You need one.
Yeah, so come and get it. We'll have them available. I might have them actually online, but no promises. Anyway, start with us, and you were just talking with Fumi and Jane about their masks and muses. Very interesting stuff that they're putting up over there. So, and at the same time, we will have Magic All Around, Marcy Pesca's new book. She's going to be there doing a book signing.
Oh, cool.
And from 5:30 to 7, we have the Food Truck Friday thing going on, which I'll talk about in a minute. And at 7 o'clock, there's the Equality for Alaskan celebration. So you can just go to the Arts Council and sit down on the lawn. You know,
wow.
It's going to be beautiful.
Yeah.
But you really should walk around. You just were speaking with Steve Henriksen from the Alaska State Museum. Admission to the museum is free on First Friday. So there, all the exhibits are up over there. The Prospector has the photography by Toby Harbinick.
Wow.
And they will be having a wine tasting. This is being offered by K&L, and that's from 6 until 8. The wine tasting has a little fee attached to it, but you can look at Toby's photography. It's always lovely. Back side of Taku Lanes, that you read about this in the paper, the mural that the two kids did. They're having an official unveiling and a reception for it from 4 to 7. So you just go to the bowling alley and walk around behind it. And that will be happening there. And there's another piece of really fun public art on Main Street, the chalkboard, Before I Die, I Want To. So as you're walking around town, swing by there and see what everybody else wants to do and then decide if it's what you want to do.
Who's responsible for that public art?
That is David Glidman at the Goldstein Improvement Group. He just read about it on a TED Talk or something like that and thought, this is cool, I can do that. And so they put one up.
It is so cool.
It is very cool. So then you go up around to Seward Street. The canvas has Alan Monroe's new exhibit, Creating Ideas. His stuff is always creative and very fun and really interesting.
Where's his stuff again?
It's at the canvas.
Okay.
And Pie in the Sky will be open. So if you're starting to fade a little, you can get some sustenance there. The Rookery has new stuff by Jim Fowler. Jim has often had his stuff there, but he's always doing wonderful new things. So there's that. Annie Kales has multi-generational jewelry. Colleen Goldrich, who everybody knows for her jewelry that she does here in town, her mother-in-law has been doing jewelry for 60 years, and I think possibly even Colleen's son will have some stuff in it. So it's sort of the Goldrich jewelry event. And as well, they'll have Constance Baltuck's new large works, it says, and Barbara Craver and Pua Maunu are now at Annie Kales, so you can stop in there. Hearthside Books has a book signing, The Gear List of the Golden Moon, What to Pack for Coastal Travel in an Open Boat. This is a new book by Dick Callahan. Hearthside will have him there doing his book signing. Let's see, then you go over to the Merchant's Wharf at Seaside Yarns, has pottery by Joyce Payne and some porcelain buttons and yarn baskets and various things, so stop in there, and then you wander over to the Kodiak Company, Coat Company, where we're still saying farewell to Bridget. I knew she couldn't leave.
Not when it's weather like this, right?
Exactly. And then there's a new little store called Northern Treasures Craft Gallery. It's down a little alley next to their main store. It's on South Franklin Street. They're having handcrafted totes and ivory jewelry and little booties and various things like that. So check them out. It's a new place. And then there's a new photography exhibit place that's called Mariella. It's right across from the library. It's in sort of a little, looks like a temporary building, I believe. And it's photography by John Marston. The exhibit is called Watercolors. So stop in around there, then go around. Well, let's see, we'll do the rendezvous last because they start late. Juno Artist Gallery is still saying goodbye to Tasha and all these people, they just can't leave. I knew it would happen. Basement Studios, but, you know, it do stop in if you didn't get a chance before. Rainforest Studio Yoga Studio has a little free yoga thing with Tammy Davis from 5:15 to 6:15, in case you're curious about yoga. Just want to try it.
She's a great teacher, too.
Yeah, and Studio 154, this is above the Alaska Liquor Cache. That's Patrice Helmar is going off, and this is sort of her last exhibit. She'll have her book there, which is called Last Call. And you head on up the hill, Aunt Claudia's Dolls is open, and I always recommend people stop in to see this. It's open Fridays and Saturday from noon to 5 as well. Vanity, which is above the Tattoo Place, has art by Abe Wiley. And then 4th Street Mountainside Wellness in the Articore building, which is on 4th Harris, I think it is. They'll be having smoothies, fitness, demos, tips, discounts on classes, and boot camps. And then you go over to Douglas. Oh, wait a minute. When did Douglas crawl into this?
I know. Funny how that works.
So we've got Douglas doing over there. The Star Kids are doing Guys and Dolls, 7:30.
That's right.
So, but back to Food Truck Friday, which is happening from 5:30 until 7 at the Jack. We have, starting at 5:30, the Juno Cello Choir. Then we have the Hula Group. And then we have Slush Not Snow. So that's something to do on Friday night, in case you didn't have anything planned.
That's right, yeah. Just planned my whole evening. Slush Not Snow, and hot off their, they were just at the fair.
So, it's going to be a wonderful evening. And then I think the weekend continues on. You know, I should mention also that up at the Tram is Tom Loker and Wayne Norland. They're always up there doing live jazz, starting at 5:30, I think. There's a tween lock-in at the Douglas Library on Friday at 6 p.m. I mentioned the Equality for All fundraiser dance and auction at the Jack at 7. So you said, Guys and Dolls, I don't know. Goldtown's got Contiki playing. 9:30 p.m. on Friday, after everything's over with, you can go to the Rendezvous and sit in with the band with Jason Caputo. So finish the evening off that way.
Cool.
Let's see, there's the Skipper's Choice Day Race from Marmion Island Day Mark in the Gastineau Channel. It's 10 a.m. Saturday morning. Should be a beautiful day for that. Star is doing King Lear on Saturday at 2. All these are over at Perseverance Theater. So don't go out to the Noise Pavilion, which is something I would do just because I'm a creature of habit. I don't know. Anyway, let's see. There's an international ballroom dance at the Jack Saturday night. The international folk dancers are offering that. I think they're tangoing and different things. So come out for that. That starts at 6:30, I believe. Cinderella is at 7:30 over at the Perseverance Theater. And at 9 p.m., you were just talking about the event that's happening at McGivney's, the Drink from the Well 1920s-themed charity event. Sunday, there's a ukulele jam at Rockwell. And Star is doing Cinderella at 2. And at 6:30, the ukuleles are going to be at the airport doing the Music on the Fly.
Cool.
Yeah, it's been really fun, the Music on the Fly thing. Let's see, Monday camps, there's all sorts of camps, wheel throwing and form line stitching and jumper camp. So if you need information on camps for this last few weeks before school starts, get on to our website and look at the calendar and get all that information. The Midsummer Vocal Choral Workshop is going on. On Tuesday, there's Summertime Family Nights at the Douglas Library at 5:30. Wednesday, it looks like we've got an opportunity, probably the last one, before they go off to Scotland, to see the JDHS Theater Department's Pippin. It's a pay-as-you-can thing. It's at Juno Douglas High School. It's at 7 on Wednesday. So give them a lot of applause and get them headed off to their festival in Scotland. Is there really a King Lear performance on Wednesday?
There really
no,
is.
Yes. Oh, wow. Oh, goodness sakes, it's just happening all over the place. And then Thursday is Guys and Dolls. So, you know, what are you doing sitting around?
I know. I should go. I feel like I should go do something now. Well, thank you so much, Nancy. And where can we get all this information online?
Yes, you can go to jahc.org and find it there. And you can also go to the KTOO website and find it there.
Nice. Well, thanks, Nancy DeCherney, with Arts Up every week. I love it.
Thank you.
And if you want to get your information about your particular event here on KTOO on Juno Afternoon, please give Jeff Brown a call here at the studio. We're always looking for really exciting events happening and people doing amazing things here in Juno and both nationally. Well, thanks so much for tuning in to Juno Afternoon today. And tomorrow looks like a great lineup also, talking about concerts in Gustavus and some books. And the opening, Jim Fowler will be here talking about his opening at the Rookery. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great day.
Obviously, this is not a positive development, and we have a wide range.